song. Is it?
Anyway. Hello, and welcome to Whose Song Is It Anyway? I'm Dr. Hayley Bosher, and for this special season of the podcast focusing on women in the music industry, I'll be your host. Thank you so much, Olga, for joining us on the Whose Song Is It Anyway podcast. I'm actually in the habit of saying us, but it's just me. There's no, Jules is not here. So thanks for joining me on this podcast for the special season focusing on women in the music industry. Can you, for our listeners who maybe don't know who you are, tell us who you are and what you do in the music industry?
Hi Hayley, thanks for having me. My name is Olga Fitzroy. I'm a recording engineer, mixer and producer. I work with bands and I do a lot of film and TV music, so recording orchestras, mixing scores for film and TV dramas.
So many things, a woman of many talents. And tell us a bit more about your career. Like, how did you get into this in the first place? How long have you been doing it?
How long have I been doing this? It's really depressing. I got my first studio job, proper studio job, in 2003. So we're coming up for 20 years. I started in music. I started off just as most teenagers, just being really, really into my music. Because I'm so old, it was kind of Britpop and grunge at the time. Proper 90s music. And at first I wanted to be a drummer in a punk band. And I also did a lot of kind of live sound engineering at pubs and things. And then I did some work experience at a theatre when I was about 16. And I got to hang out with the sound and lighting techs and just kind of play with the mixing desks. And that's what kind of sparked my interest, I guess, in kind of getting into the technical side of music. And then I went to college, studied music and sound recording, and kind of just got more into the tech side and less into kind of hanging around rehearsal rooms waiting for the rest of your band to show up. So by the end of my college course, sort of that was 2 years, I decided I really wanted to get a job in studios and start just randomly knocking on doors of studios in Glasgow. And they all kind of pretty much laughed at me because I didn't know anybody. I was just literally a random stranger who'd done a music course knocking on their door, and they weren't about to give me a job. So then I realised I needed to do a bit more work. Basically, I needed to get somewhere where I could get my foot into the door of all these brilliant studios that I'd read about and heard about. So I ended up applying to the University of Surrey to do a course called the Tonmeister course. And the real reason for that was because they make you do a year in industry. So that course was kind of my way into getting an opportunity to at least get a job interview with a recording studio, never mind just getting a job, but just getting an interview, because my family are teachers and academics, they've got no connections in the music industry. So that was, I felt, the only way that I was ever going to get even in front of someone that would give me a chance to start working in a studio. And I did the course and I was lucky enough to get an interview with Air Studios and they offered me a job as a runner in 2003. So that's how I got my way into the studio, and I kind of never left that studio. I still work there quite a lot these days, even though I'm freelance now. So for 20 years on and off, I've been working at Air Studios.
I love it. What a great story. And that's how it all began. I also like that, you know, it wasn't easy, but you learned from your sort of challenges and was like, okay, I'll go and do a course. I'll figure this out. You know, you weren't deterred. Definitely feeling resilience from you already. So you started, and also 20 years, that's amazing. I mean, I'm so excited to interview you and ask you loads of questions because that's a lot of experience and you can share with the listeners what you've learned in that time. So be proud of that. Definitely not depressing. So what happened? Talk to us what happened next from 2003, from being a runner. How did you kind of move forward in your career?
Yeah, so being a runner is basically you're a general dog's body in the studio, but it was a really nice atmosphere and really interesting work. Obviously, I think in my first week, the first week back in the day, you would do on reception, so you would learn how the phones worked, you'd meet everybody that came in and out of the building. So I did my week on reception, and I think in that week, I think Robbie Williams came in, I think I ordered a birthday cake for George Michael, and then, you know, you do the usual teas and coffees. And then once you've sort of figured out how the building works, then you're allowed to go into the sessions. again, mainly teas and coffees and helping with setups. And then sort of towards the end of the year, you might be assisting on simpler sessions with an experienced engineer. You might be their only assistant for a really simple session. For anything more complex, they'd get someone more experienced. But you sort of gradually work your way up, get more responsibility as you go on. And then I obviously went back to uni, but still carried on doing bits of temp work at the studio, and then came back full time in 2005. And so I did the sort of runner assistant route for about 10 years. I mean, people sort of think it's madness, but basically it does seem to be the way, and it hasn't really changed. In the big studios, you end up working for about 10 years in these junior roles of runner and assistant. And I say they're junior because they're not particularly well paid, and they're kind of the lowest, I guess, level of seniority of people in a session. But that doesn't mean it's unskilled. Like, a lot of the time, the assistant engineers have probably the most responsibility. They're operating all the equipment, particularly if it's outside engineers who might not know the studio. There's a lot of responsibility on the assistant engineers. They're ultimately pressing the record button of a really famous artist or a massive orchestra that costs a lot of money to record. So it is a lot of responsibility. So I sort of went along that path for about 10 years. And then towards the end of it, you kind of get more responsibilities of actually engineering and mixing and maybe picking up bits of sessions where the more senior engineer isn't available. And again, the same as the assisting, you gradually get more and more responsibility. And in the end, I ended up being offered an engineering role on the Coldplay album Ghost Stories. And that for me was the point at which I decided to go freelance, because it was, you know, it was a few months' work initially. It ended up being almost a year, but there's enough work there to make me go, right, I can afford to go freelance. I've got a few months that is definitely guaranteed, because with all freelance work, it's always the risk, isn't it? You never know where your next gig's going to come from. And I think that sort of trajectory is pretty typical for these really big studios, Air Studios, Abbey Road Studios. I know their engineers aren't freelance, but it's the same sort of trajectory of being an assistant engineer for about a decade before you get given a bit more sort of autonomy and responsibility and creative freedom on projects.
So during that 10 years, were you like kind of content doing what you were doing, or did you always have like bigger dreams and you knew it was a means to an end?
It was sort of a bit of both, really. I think there were definitely points where I was learning a lot. You know, I might be assisting on a really complex session for the first time, and that felt really challenging. But then there'd also be points where I'd be like, I really know how to do this. And then towards the end of it, there might be points where you're working with someone going, I could do this job. You know, you're working perhaps with an outside engineer who you know is getting paid 10 times what you're getting paid, and you're going, I could do this job. And I'm sure assistants feel the same about me coming in engineering. And there's definitely some assistants I work that could absolutely do my job and do production jobs as well. So it varies. It depends on the session. I think I've generally been really, really lucky and worked with some really amazing people, both as an assistant, as an engineer. And to be honest, not really, you know, everyone always goes, who is your most difficult client? Who is most horrible? But they're honestly, I don't think there's anybody who's been horrible. Everyone's been a real pleasure to work with. Also, I guess, being really lucky to work somewhere like Air Studios, the artists and composers that come in are also always really grateful to work there and really enjoy their experience. So, you know, even in all different sort of levels of roles, it's always been quite an enjoyable experience.
Okay, so I won't ask you who is your most difficult client. I'll ask you what is one of your favourite projects that you've worked on?
Favourite projects? I mean, I've said this a few times in interviews, but I do think it's so incredibly special and it's an absolute privilege to work on this. And that was what I believe to be the last ever Beatles recording. So for the Love album that came out, I think in 2006, which was basically, I guess, it was a mixture of kind of newly discovered demo recordings of various Beatles songs. It's for the Love Show in Las Vegas, and a bit of a mashup of old bits of lost recordings. And they had found a demo of While My Guitar Gently Weeps, and Sir George Martin, who was alive at that time and was, I think, the chair or had some sort of like senior position at Air Studios, he was actually asked to write a new arrangement for While My Guitar Gently Weeps. So he came in and conducted this new string arrangement for this old Beatles demo. And I was lucky enough to be the Pro Tools operator, so running the recording equipment and assistant engineer on that session. And that was just a really, really special session. I remember Sir George, he was quite elderly at this point, so you could tell it was quite an elderly man walking into the room. And then the minute he started conducting, it's just, it took 20 years off him. It's like you're watching a young George Martin conduct a Beatles arrangement. It felt really special, and I think all the musicians there appreciated that as well.
Sounds just utterly magical, and I just also love how relaxed and chilled you are. You're just like, oh yeah, I just worked on this. And you do this, you know, you're like, oh yeah, Coldplay, no big deal. And it's people listening to this are going to be like, whoa, that is incredible, so impressive, so inspirational, amazing. So you're obviously excellent at what you do. And so one thing I was quite interested to ask you about was, as a female engineer, how has that experience been for you? You know, are you aware of your gender at work?
I definitely am. Possibly I was less so when I first started. I think I was just so amazed to even have gotten the opportunity to work there. It probably didn't really cross my mind very much. And then as I kind of progressed a little bit, did more and more assisting, I got very few sexist comments. I mean, once in a blue moon, someone would say something inappropriate or just, you know, a bit annoying. But I didn't really see that as a systemic problem for me doing my job. And I know that's not the same story for everyone, but I certainly didn't feel that it was holding me back. And in some ways, I guess, because at that time there's so few women working in studios, I was maybe a little bit more memorable. So when clients would come in and then maybe come back and ask for you again, they'd remember your name and they'd remember who you were, and you would get, you know, you'd get repeat clients through that, I think. And that was perhaps a bit easier for me because there was something different about me that clients would remember. I imagine there were probably some clients who maybe expressed a preference for male engineers, but that stuff never got back to me, so I didn't really see it as an obstacle. I think I found it more of a problem as I got a bit older and being freelance, and then when I had a child. And that's where the sort of real huge difference started. And, you know, I'm sure it's the same for a lot of women in all sorts of different industries. But it's the minute that you have children, you suddenly just travel back in time to the 1950s. And I found that quite shocking, I guess, especially because I'd had such a positive experience for most of my career. Then the difference, and not just in my workplace, but just in society in general, as to how men's and women's roles are supposed to be different once they have children, and the whole infrastructure, the way it's set up, that's what I found really shocking.
So can you expand on that a little bit for us to try and understand more, like what the challenges were in particular around that when you had a child?
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, I think the sort of idea of pregnancy and maternity discrimination was already there. I definitely didn't tell people that I was pregnant until I kind of had to, until it was really apparent. Yeah. For a while, I just pretended I was just eating a lot. And I did that, you know, I didn't particularly think about it, but I just thought, I'm not going to get booked for things if people know I'm pregnant. People are going to make assumptions about how committed I am to my work. So I'm just going to try and not tell people. And then the big thing for me, which has probably shaped a lot of what I've done since having a child in terms of activism, the big thing for me was finding out that as a self-employed woman, I was the only person in my family who could take parental leave. My husband wasn't allowed to take any. And self-employed women are only allowed to take maternity allowance. They're not allowed to do shared parental leave. Self-employed men are not allowed to take any paternity leave. And suddenly I just found out that basically it was all on me, and society had decided that as a self-employed woman who's already working in quite a precarious industry with all of that that comes with self-employment, that I had to shut down my business for the best part of a year, and there were no alternatives open to me. And that was really shocking, but it also galvanized me because it made me kind of, out of the blue, really, start a political campaign to try and change the law.
I think that's the thing with this kind of stuff, is that it doesn't occur to you always until, like you said, you come across it or it's suddenly relevant to you. And I think people listening will be hearing what you've just said for the first time because they haven't got there yet in their lives, or they don't actually know anyone who's been through that. And it is really shocking because, so I don't know, I go through phases sometimes where I'm like, things are so much better than they used to be. And then you get blindsided by this thing where you're like, what? Like, what year is it? Why is this still a thing? So I'm glad we're talking about it for those who don't know. And also the next question is obviously, so tell us about the campaign and what we can do about it.
Yeah, so I started the campaign just by accident, really, because I kept reading these regulations and it just said there in black and white, if you're self-employed, you can't have shared parental leave. And I just thought, there must be some mistake. I'm just going to email some people. I'm sure they'll fix it when I point it out to them. my son is now 7 and the law has not yet changed. But I did, I emailed some people. I emailed the woman who was the Lib Dem minister at the time in the coalition government when they brought in shared parental leave, Jo Swinson, and she was actually really helpful. We had a phone call and she said, you know, there wasn't really an ideological reason as to why we didn't bring it in for self-employed people. It was just the time scales of getting it done. It was just before the election. We thought we'd rather get something done for employed people than nothing at all. So I thought, fair enough. And I just kept sort of writing to MPs. I wrote to the Music Producers Guild, of which I was just an ordinary member at the time. I hadn't really got involved with them very much. And they introduced me to UK Music, who are the big umbrella body that represent all the different strands of the commercial music industry. And they were super helpful and introduced me to some more MPs. So I ended up having a meeting with Tracy Brabin, who is now the mayor of West Yorkshire, but she was then the MP for Batley and Spen. And she was so helpful because she really got it. She'd been an actor in her previous career and had brought up a couple of kids whilst freelance. So she completely got the issues and the difficulties that I was facing. And she decided to do a thing called a 10-minute rule bill, which is a private member's bill where an MP, they don't need to be a government MP, but they bring in a proposal for a law and it gets read in Parliament. It can technically, if the government supports it, it can then pass and become law. But even if it doesn't, it will go through some of the stages of the parliamentary process and get a lot of attention and raise awareness. So she actually brought in this bill that we called the Selfie Leave Bill, the Shared Parental Leave for Self-Employed People. And I managed to get a bunch of musicians and actors to attend a protest at Parliament. We got quite a lot of press coverage on it. And I think we managed to raise a lot of awareness. And we also got the government to commit to doing a study, a review of parental leave. So that all felt really positive. But then obviously politics has been quite chaotic over the past few years. So since then, since we had this review, they've done the review, but they haven't actually published their findings. And it doesn't seem like it's a priority for this government at the moment to change the law. So it's something we're still pushing on, but we haven't actually got a resolution to it yet.
Well, thank you for the work that you've done on this. And, you know, let's acknowledge the progress that you have made, because I think people I know, and lots of those people are women, but we put a lot of pressure on ourselves sometimes to do everything and be everything for everyone. And I kind of love it in some ways, because I love that attitude of like, this is nonsense. This is not okay. I'm going to do something about it, you know, rather than just sit at home and complain about it. So I think that's amazing. If anyone is listening and they want to help or get involved, what can they do?
So I think write to your MP. I think doesn't matter what party they're from, just write to them if you're affected by the situation. And in your own words, to say how it affects you, what difference having a more fair parental leave system for self-employed people would make. We've also got a website, parentalpayequality.org.uk, and that has updates from the campaign. I've been a bit slack at updating it. I will try and do some more this week. But yeah, I think just keep let politicians know how you feel and how it's affecting your life. I think it's really valuable.
Thanks. I think that's a really good tip, and it applies to a lot of things. And I think it's one of those ones where people think, oh, it sounds really, that's all I've got to do. It's so simple, send an email. And you're like, yeah, you know, get involved in politics, whether it's this or something else that affects you or you care about. It's as simple as that. So in the meantime, whilst we were going to send our emails, for sure, and then in the meantime, I was wondering if you had any kind of tips or advice for women who maybe have had a child and they're trying to get back into work, because you obviously did that, and I don't know if you had any kind of lessons that you learned along the way you'd like to share.
Yeah, there's a few things, I think. In the first sort of year or two before my son was in nursery, I relied quite a lot on babysitting services. So you sign up with an agency and then you can contact them at quite short notice and go, oh, by the way, I need a babysitter for this random amount of hours, which it tends to be in the music industry. So I found that quite helpful. I think also, like, once you have got a kid, you can be a bit more strict with clients and tell, you know, make them tell you actually when they want you to work. So, I mean, particularly music, people are so vague. So you can actually tie people down a bit more. And you might not be used to it and you might feel a bit uncomfortable doing it. But I think people do understand. And also the other thing that I found, and, you know, maybe some of the listeners are probably really good at this already, but actually to keep your rates up as well. So actually think about when you're working, think about how much your childcare costs. And then don't let clients take the mick out of you with really ludicrous rates just because you want to get back into it. Even if you are a bit desperate to get back into it, don't let them know. And stick to your guns. I think that's helpful. And again, like quite often, that you'd be surprised that actually people go, yeah, absolutely, that's fine. So I think be confident. People want to work with you. Just because you've had a kid doesn't mean they don't want to work with you. Your skills are still valuable. So make sure that you're charging properly for it. I mean, I've got a lot more confident. Having said that, I kind of didn't tell anyone I was pregnant at first. Now I'm quite happy talking about the fact that I'll happily do this job, but I need to organise my childcare. And it's not a bad thing. And I think, particularly nowadays, I think people have got a lot more used to people having families and family commitments that they need to be aware of. So I think just be confident in that side of it and stick to your guns, have your boundaries. Doesn't mean you're being unhelpful, but just go, okay, this is when I need to finish. I need to know whether you need me on this day, by this day, so I can sort out childcare. And actually, it'll probably make your diary generally a lot easier to run, I think.
Those are all great tips. Thank you. I had a question about confidence, because I think this is something that's come up in a few of the interviews so far. And it relates also, we've also discussed asking for an appropriate amount of money for what you do. And I think those two are kind of linked, and there's like the whole self-worth thing in there. Like, when you reflect on your career, and you mentioned the feeling more confident now, do you know how you kind of cultivated that confidence? Or was there a moment when you, maybe you can't pinpoint exactly when, but when you reflect, you're like, oh, that helped me to develop my confidence?
I think probably a lot of it is time and experience. I think a lot of freelancers will have that little gap in their diary, whether it's like a couple of weeks or a month or more, and they're like, oh my God, I'm never going to work again. And we all have those. But now I'm sort of, when those gaps appear, it's like, I've been doing this 20 years, I will work again, it's fine. And it's taken, I think you have to go through those gaps and come out the other side and realise that, yes, you will work again. And once you've done that, I don't know how many times, but there comes a point where you've done it enough times that your brain will actually believe that you will work again.
It's like positive reinforcement.
Exactly. And, you know, you still have doubts. I remember after COVID, I had a really long gap. At first, like, everyone came back, it was really busy. And suddenly there was this kind of hole, I guess, where a bunch of TV productions hadn't been made. They didn't need the music recording. And even though I was pretty confident, I still started to get the fear a little bit. So it's not totally gone away, but I think confidence is really important. I read a stat somewhere, it's from Ipsy, who look after self-employed people, and they measured the self-employed gender pay gap as being 41%, which is shocking. They put a lot of the reasoning onto it being confidence. I don't think it's all of that. I think there's a lot of other reasons, including enforced career breaks for childcare, prejudice, all sorts of things. But I'm sure confidence is a factor. I'm really lucky in that I've got management who will negotiate my rates for me. And they're both two very confident women, and I have complete faith in them. So I don't need to have those awkward conversations. But they're capable of getting me certain rates, so I know that I'm worth that. And I think that's really helpful. So yeah, for me personally, I find management really helpful. And the fact that they're able to get those rates, I'm just like, that boosts my confidence and means that I'm then more confident not to accept really crappy rates off other people. So it's just, yeah, it's really handy to have that.
Yeah, and I think you're right. Confidence is a factor, but it's definitely not, you know, oh, you're confident and suddenly the pay gap's gone. Because yeah, it's also, you know, it's a society thing that's reflected also in the industry, and freelancers probably everywhere, not necessarily in the music industry. And I've, for me as well, because obviously I work in the music industry, but I also work in academia and kind of in law, and in my salary is from academia, and there's a pay gap there, as there is everywhere. But one of the things I do anyway is, having read about this and read all the horrifying statistics about how men are more likely to negotiate their pay, they're more likely to apply for jobs they're less qualified for, and all of this stuff, which it's not about like divide, and you know, I'm not actually saying that what they're doing is wrong at all. If anything, I'm taking that as inspiration to be like, okay, so I should negotiate for my pay and I should ask for appropriate rates. And there's the kind of like contextualizing what you're getting paid for is your skill, your expertise, and the job that you do. If you take less, you're kind of undermining yourself, but also everybody else doing what you're doing as well, because you're driving down the rate. So there's also that kind of sense of responsibility, anyway, I feel, to ask for more on behalf of everyone, not only on behalf of myself. And that's something that also helps me to do it, because it is sometimes uncomfortable and
yeah,
they're not your favorite conversations, but you're doing it knowing that you're doing it for good reason. And I feel like confidence is important, but it's not the only factor in why we have a pay gap there. So thank you for sharing all of that. The next question, I feel like we've kind of answered along the way, but just to explicitly kind of summarize maybe, or perhaps you've got something else to add, I wanted to ask you, what do you think we can do to better support women in the music industry? And what can the music industry do to become more inclusive and equitable?
How long have you got?
All the time. Go.
So I think in terms of entry level positions, I think studios, I guess I'll talk about it more in the terms of studios, because that's where I've got the direct experience. Entry level, I think studios are being better. They're certainly employing many more women than they were at the point where I started. I think sexual harassment is an issue. I'm really lucky that I've not really encountered any serious examples of it personally in my career, but I'm very much aware that it is an issue. I think one thing that will help with that will be setting up this independent standards authority that the music industry are in the process of setting up. I think it's still going to be a while, but I think that will be helpful, because when I was on the board of the Music Producers Guild, we conducted some research for a parliamentary inquiry on misogyny in music. And the results of that were pretty depressing. And I think an independent standards authority where complaints can be reported and dealt with appropriately by people outside of the workplace, I think will be hugely helpful if it's done well and if it's done correctly. And then in terms of pregnancy and maternity discrimination, which I think is the other area that I've already touched on, where women are treated differently to men and therefore lose out, I think that's partly to do with the parental leave stuff that I've talked about. I think it's also to do with societal change more generally and attitudes and the other infrastructure around having children, which is obviously childcare, which has been in the news a little bit at the moment. The sort of Rishi Sunak had said he would do something about it, but didn't actually have any proposal. I think the next general election, I think all the parties are going to have to put together some serious proposals on childcare, because we have really low productivity in the UK and the most expensive childcare in Europe. Like, it doesn't take a genius to work out what's behind that. So I think we fundamentally need a better childcare model. At the moment, you don't get any support with your childcare until your child is three. So if you have two children, perhaps, that are close together, that might put a woman out of work for 6 years or more. It just doesn't make sense. And the rest of Europe is way ahead of us on that. And I think that will have knock-on effects, not just in music, obviously, but everywhere. that people can afford to have their children looked after, and the often the lower earner in a relationship, which sadly does often tend to be women, are usually the ones that are making those career sacrifices in order to look after children. So I think that's a big one. I think, again, people listening, people working in music, especially men, if they're also aware of these issues, and then don't let their female partner pick up all the childcare things, actually step up and be proactive. Because I think often the institutions that we deal with around children, schools, doctors, all those things, they will automatically communicate with the mother. They'll call the mother when the child's off sick. They will put all the diary appointments, email them to the mums, and that then puts the mental load onto the mum. Sometimes it might just be actually easier for the mum, if she gets all this information, to do all these childcare things at the expense of her career. So I think there's also not just the role for women to get their partners to do more, but actually for men to step up and go, this is my child, my responsibility, and share those loads a bit more evenly.
I think that's such a good point. And I think it's also really important for us, because sometimes there's an important space needed for women to come together as a community and, you know, share and support each other. But at the same time, to make society and the music industry a better place, this has to be a team effort, right? It's not like we can do this entirely on our own. We want, and there are, you know, we talk about the statistics and stuff for sexual harassment and pay gap. There's a lot of data that shows there are many problems. But there are also a lot of incredible men out there that do care. And we've been lucky enough to work with lots of them. And that's both in terms, or you know lots of them, your brother or your husband or whatever. It's not, you know, in the home as well as in the workplace. And I think it's really important to bring them into the conversation and not to demonize and make them feel kind of, you know, villainized a little bit, because then they might be nervous. But to bring them in, and also for them, for the men, like you said, to step up and be like, okay, I don't really get this, because I've just been brought up in a world where I do whatever I like, but I'm gonna learn and I'm gonna listen. Because you just ask your partner and they will tell you, you know, yeah, I get all these emails and you don't even know about it, because it's so much quicker for me to just reply. But also for the woman to not try to do everything and actually ask, because there's something else that's come up. Like, I don't know if you feel like this, but I definitely do, like, struggle sometimes to ask for help, or I can get annoyed about it, but I'll go and do it myself. And so it's kind of like, you know, thinking about it from both sides, to be like, men, come on, step up. There's more you can do. There's more you can learn. There's so much literature around this now. You can read about it. You can ask women about it. We'll talk about it with you. And also maybe a little note to self, or to us women, to be like, bring them into the conversation, ask for help, and, you know, create space for them to also join in the responsibility. I don't know if any of that resonates with you.
Yeah, definitely. I think maternal gatekeeping is definitely an issue. And it's, you know, I don't want to, like, blame women for their own problems, because clearly they are not to blame for their own problems. But at the same time, society's created this, like, sort of image of the perfect mum, and even those of us who consider ourselves feminists and don't buy into it, you're still influenced by it. Like, social media is full of it, and I think there's definitely also, like, a pressure to, as well as being a feminist, also not complaining about anything, also not nagging your partner, also being the perfect mum, like, all of those things. And, like, clearly you can't do all those things, but I think there's definitely that societal pressure, and I think women need to resist it if they can, as well as obviously men stepping up too.
I agree. So before I ask you my last question, I just wanted to give you the space here to champion anything that you're currently working on that you want to share, or something that you've completed recently that you're really proud of, that people can find.
So, slightly topical, because a certain book is out at the moment. Season 5 of The Crown is something I've worked on recently, and I'm really proud of how the score sounds on that. Martin Phipps is the composer.
I love it. I mean, I know people have different views about The Crown, but you can't deny the production is amazing and the music is incredible. So I'm sure that was a lot of fun to work on, and definitely something that we can all find and listen to, and we'll look out for your name in the credits. So, well done. Congratulations. So my last question, which I've asked everyone, is, can you name a favourite? Doesn't have to be the favourite. I'd like to say that so it's, like, not so much pressure. You know what I mean? Because it's a hard question. A favourite female music maker, and you can think of that as broadly as you like, anyone who contributes to the making of music, like of all time ever, and someone who you're currently, like, presently inspired by.
Okay, all time ever for me, I think, is quite easy, is Debbie Harry. She's just an absolute legend. I love all the Blondie back catalogue and their new stuff as well. I saw them at Brixton Academy a few years ago. Still amazing. She looks amazing, puts on a great show. Absolutely love Debbie Harry.
Great answer.
And currently, I don't know if I've got a particular favourite currently, but I've got artists that I really like at the moment. I really like Shingi, who used to be in Noisettes. Really like her new record, particularly like the song that bigs up Crystal Palace and the dinosaurs.
Love it.
Who else do I like? I mean, I quite like the kind of indie bands like Wet Leg. Yeah, lots of good stuff out at the minute. I don't know if there's like one that I love more than any others, but they're the kind of people I'm listening to at the moment. Oh, and The Anchoress as well.
Great. I mean, it's kind of, you know, as I said in the beginning, we're here to celebrate women in music. So it's just really nice to hear people talk about women that they're listening to. And I think I'm going to make a playlist of everybody's answers. So people listening
definitely.
Can check out, because some, you know, we might not have heard of everyone that people mention. And also sometimes it's not that I haven't heard. I'm just like, oh, I haven't listened to that for ages, actually. So it's really nice to kind of share and shine a light on some of the amazing women in music, including yourself. So thank you so much, Olga, for coming on the podcast today and talking to us. I feel like you've shared a lot of actually amazing advice and wisdom that you've picked up along the way. And we look forward to seeing all the amazing stuff that I'm sure you continue to do in hopefully your long and thriving career.
Thanks very much. Thank you for having me.
Thanks for listening. And if you enjoyed this episode, please like, share, and subscribe.